Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group. We are a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. This podcast is an opportunity for our two studios to come together each week and provide an insight into the creative industry from our unique point of view as a bridge between clients and creatives. Using the internet as our lens, we hope to explore a variety of current events, opinions, and tools to provide thought-provoking conversation for anyone whose job it is to bring creative things to life. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using the Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro podcatchers, you can directly link to the articles discussed here, as well as get enhanced visual content as we move along. This week, we'll be discussing 3D Bitmoji, politics and design, millennial pink, and being a design generalist. Much like our IRL Open Tabs events, which you can find out more about at opentabs.rodeo, we're digging deep into our JW network of amazing people to contribute their own link and thoughts to each episode. And today we are delighted to welcome Frank Ogugliaro, Deputy Design Director at Wired San Francisco. I always want to shout Wired when it's written in all caps. Wired! Wired San Francisco to the studio as this week's special guest. Before, Frank was making incredible work at Wired. He served as a designer at none other than the New York Times Magazine. He was also art director at Billboard and deputy art director at Esquire, as well as scoring him gigs at some of the best publications in the arena. His work has also earned him recognition from the Art Directors Club, the Society of Publication Designers, and DNAD. How does he do it? How does he find time to join us on the show? We have no idea. We're very glad he's here broaching the third time zone, I think for the first time, East Coast, West Coast, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere together at once. Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm working right now. So we're closing the magazine. So I find time by working and doing this at the same time. So yeah.
Well, we appreciate it enormously.
We really do appreciate it. Well, there's a lot of links that have been open in our browsers this week, and I'm going to get started with something from the New York Times. And this is something that my dad sends me. My dad always loves sending me links. He always sends them on different platforms as well. So you never know where it's going to come from. Sometimes it might come from Messenger.
See, that's like how I feel about you, Jeremy. Sometimes like I look at my, like I hadn't been on Instagram in like over a week, and then suddenly there was like 400 things from you.
My dad's the same. WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, email, 4 different email accounts.
Well, this is a surprisingly in-depth look at animation specifically as it is done at Snapchat and specifically around their recently launched feature, which is kind of 3D Bitmoji. They're talking about one piece in particular. This, I don't know if it's around because I don't use Snapchat because I'm 100 years old. We do use Bitmoji, where Bitmoji is kind of the static version of, you kind of input your basic facial structure and then it kind of applies it over the skeleton of 100 or thousands of different kind of images that you can kind of use as kind of stickers.
Yeah, and then Snapchat bought the company.
Snapchat bought the company in 2016. Yeah. Not only by the company, like this was, I thought this was amazing that the company was four Russian siblings that, because that's a big thrust of this piece, or are they?
Well, they actually weren't from Bitstrip. They were doing other stuff. These four insanely talented Russian siblings that I just don't know how anyone else could ever live up to. Their parents must be so proud.
I felt this burying the lead a bit. I wanted to hear more about that. Like that was interesting. But really what it was kind of talking about and what I thought was so interesting also that didn't get a lot of play here was how this is a new domain kind of for animators especially, and how in Snapchat as a business, they have kind of brought in animators from DreamWorks and Pixar. And there's a whole kind of team of storyboarders, riggers, everyone who's kind of working on this kind of content. And then they talk about how the kind of content develops and how it's storyboarded and how they specifically use AR as the platform to display this animated content and what the life cycle of it is. But in terms of, I guess, the changing atmosphere for kind of creatives in a professional scope, that was something that I thought was really interesting, especially coming off the back of a recent article by Coy Vinn, which I wanted to kind of link to here as well, where he's talking about how Apple, with what they're doing with the App Store, in terms of how a lot of editorial designers who were kind of working in New York at a lot of places that Frank had worked at are now kind of at Apple, kind of taking this approach to editorial design, putting this kind of completely different context. So yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to talk about now. And Frank, I'd love to hear a bit more about your perspective on this. The story is almost always the same every time you kind of read it. It's like, this is kind of new tech. We don't know kind of how it's going to be used or how it's going to kind of come across, but here's how one company is using it. So I'm interested in your perspective on, how you kind of see that developing in a editorial design sense, and also kind of how you see your own kind of career developing as an editorial designer in this new landscape.
As far as like it being a tool that we use or respond to, or technology that we respond to, it's not something that we're quite taking on just yet. I'm not sure if you guys are aware, but publishing is kind of a slow moving machine. And then like it takes a minute for us to catch up to new technologies, as it were. And so I think we'll probably take on AR in the next 10 to 15 years. So I'm not quite worried about that being part of our like our landscape. Not saying that I'm not opposed to it. I just think it's we're far off.
The career of an editorial designer has kind of shifted in terms of, you know, especially kind of with what Apple's doing and the kind of these big hires. Like, do a lot of people that you work with, do you know a lot of people that have kind of moved over there, or who have kind of moved away from magazines but still kind of maintained the role as designers in this way?
Oh, sure. I mean, we just lost an art director to Apple. My boss went to Apple recently. It's strange because Apple has a point of view that they're creating editorial content. And I guess it depends on what you define as editorial content, because a lot of it is that sort of brand marketing content with an editorial perspective, because it's not quite journalism. You know, like what we do here at Wired is still journalism, and I have a high value in that personally for the kind of work I do or the kind of work I pursue. And Apple, I think, is trying to create an editorial voice, but it's just like it's a different landscape. I mean, it's still marketing material. It's still like grounded in selling apps or laptops or whatever it may be. I don't mean to come off too negative about it, but it
ties in nicely to what we're going to be talking about later. But no, definitely go on.
I think it's a little strange. I think, you know, Apple is very well regarded in the design community, obviously, and it's seen as a prestige place to work. But I hope these designers are contributing to the design landscape the way they were working in editorial design, as far as like influencing design and design thinking and ways to tell stories. And I hope Apple is giving these people the same opportunity to do that.
I mean, yeah, speaking of telling stories, I mean, that's kind of something going back in the other foot here with the more going back to AR kind of tech. We experimented recently with our field guide where it's like, well, using AR seems like a natural extension to show animated and motion content in a print form. Lara, this is an article that you really like responded to as well. Like, what are the things that you picked up from here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because AR has for so long been at that sort of tipping point where it's like everyone's like, this is the new big thing, but we don't know how to use it, as you're saying, you know. And it's just like always just teetering on that edge, and this is such a huge topic to think about, you know, AR as a whole and how it's going to affect our society. But you know, this week with Frank coming onto the show, I've obviously sort of got into a bit of a hole in thinking about AR and how it specifically relates to and affects sort of like publishers and print media. And I was reading this interview with Francesco Marconi, who is the strategy manager and AI co-lead at the Associated Press. And he sort of describes AR and immersive media as this sort of method of satisfying the craving of news consumers to get closer to the story. And I thought that that was kind of like an interesting concept. And I've been trying to think deeply about whether that's actually true. Like, is that something that consumers actually want? You know, does it add to journalism, or does it just sort of make it more bulky? And also, you know, is creating AR content even compatible with the current sort of standard workflow of editorial content and sort of all these sorts of things? And, you know, so you've got sort of like, I was looking at like Quartz, who sort of jumped on the AR bandwagon like quite quickly after the launch of ARKit. I kind of like, they've got their Quartz news app. If you haven't used it, it's basically just like a sort of a fake messaging app where they send you news updates, kind of like the ABC News one and Messenger, but like it's freestanding. Anyway, but they've sort of integrated AR within that. And it's been kind of cool to see, but it is still a bit gimmicky. The one I saw most recently was they had like a news story about a new rocket that like something that like NASA was working on, blah, blah, blah. And then they basically had like a 3D model of the rocket that you could sort of like look at and walk around sort of in your space. It was like, to be fair, it was like, it was really cool. It was, I really, really enjoyed it. I think what was interesting is like, it sort of can add a layer to stories that are, I guess, more just like featurey rather than news. Like I still can't figure out how AR could be used in like a daily news kind of way. But I mean, maybe it's, I think it's something to do with the speed of how long it takes to actually generate that content makes it a bit tricky. But you've also got stuff like, you know, the New York Times did their Winter Olympics stuff. I don't know if you saw that. They had like these ice skaters that you could sort of look at. And I was like, why do I want to look at these ice skaters?
Well, that's the tricky thing. It's really about this kind of creating this additional layer. And like, I don't know, like talking to Frank just really kind of reminded me of reading Wired in the late 90s. The QCat was this crazy little, it looked like a laying down mouse, and it was like a barcode reader, and it was like the biggest thing for like a year, and magazines would give them away. And I remember buying Wired once, and I think it was packaged kind of there, and it's like you had to kind of have, it was a USB kind of, it literally looked like a mouse. I'm going to show you this picture, Lara. Yeah, and so,
oh my
like,
God.
So you had it.
Looks like something else.
You have it plugged in, and then like you have to kind of scan the piece to kind of get more information in there. But yeah, like, you know, creating that additional layer there, and I think that's the interesting thing in AR, where it has to remove that kind of barrier, like either through hardware or ideally kind of through contact
lenses
or something else.
Completely. And I think like as both a consumer of these things and at times in my life, you know, a creator of editorial content, it's been really interesting to think about this week, because I can't sort of decide at this stage in its development if AR is like truly helping to make storytelling richer or if it's basically just sort of embellishment still. And I think where I often, but like not always, sit is that like it doesn't hurt, but it's not necessarily like transformative. And I saw a quote from someone, and I'm sorry, I can't remember right now who it was, but they said about AR that it's not a game changer, it's a game tweaker. And I think that's not true in the long term, you know, but I think currently that's sort of how I feel. And how it's currently being employed, it still just is kind of gimmicky. But then again, like there was one piece I wanted to talk about, which was something that the Washington Post did. And they used AR in a pretty unique way during their coverage of the Freddie Gray trial. So they basically use like 3D character models, audio maps, and sort of text from court documents and witness testimony. And they created this like AR walkthrough that sort of depicted the actual interaction with the police that led to Gray's death. And so as like a user, you could actually choose from which angle and like from which point in the altercation you wanted to experience the encounter. And I think, you know, this is really interesting in a story where so much of the debate was actually around the differences in what prosecutors and defense say about when and how he was hurt. And like, it's all, a lot of it is about interpretation of that altercation. So, you know, it's interesting to think about how AR can be used in stories where it's actually, you know, really helpful, if not crucial, to explore like different perspectives. And in these cases, an interactive sort of visual layer can help people to engage with and understand the different facets of a situation. It was like quite a literally exploring different perspectives.
I think that's really interesting, and that's going to really segue us very nicely into our next link, because this is something that Bianca brought up from the Walker Art Museum, their kind of magazine, and it really kind of takes a much more political approach to design. And I think when we're talking about AR, this kind of idea of a medium that can, I guess, enhance empathy is something that does have a lot of potential political repercussions from there. This piece, I mean, I will let Bianca talk a bit more about it. It's something that I felt pretty conflicted about. But B, tell us about where you found this piece, what it is, and why you chose it.
I think I stumbled on this on Twitter. And it was written by a guy.
Like most things in life.
It's either Twitter or LinkedIn. It was written by a guy called Eric Carter, who is an Oakland-based graphic designer and art director. And he's worked at places like Google, MTV, and the New York Times. The essay was featured on The Gradient, which seems to be a digital magazine published by Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, which I actually had no idea existed, but it looks really cool. So I kind of want to go to Minneapolis and check it out. And the magazine's tagline is "Mapping the Gradient Between Art and Design." And the essay is like fairly long-winded, so I'll try and summarize it as best that I can. But Eric basically approached The Gradient with the idea to contribute a critical op-ed that addresses what's not being said or valued by graphic designers practicing in what he refers to as an ever tumultuous and high stakes world, a world that can benefit from voices of opposition or reason in the face of inequality and justice. So he, in this essay, asks the question, what has become of the profession we call graphic design? And touches on some core problems facing the industry today, including graphic design's failure to examine its societal implications, the profession's obsession with personality and itself, and the lack of inclusion in design's history and in the current discipline. He has some pretty strong opinions on the industry and where it is now. And I'm going to quote directly from this essay, but it's probably worth having a read. And to quote Eric, one of the explicit effects of branding is that it can elevate products without outlining their true implications. A change of font in a logo can increase worth of the product it's selling, but it can also deny access from people who may need it or trick people into thinking it's something it's not. Graphic design can do more to intensify income inequality, even if it's in a passive way, than it can to reduce it. Blogs such as Brand New celebrate logo redesigns and tend to talk more about the font and color choices than what the companies actually represent. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are raised on Kickstarter for reissues of corporate design manuals when perhaps graphic designers could support more timely projects instead of throwing money at these fetishized monuments of capitalist nostalgia. Oftentimes, if graphic designers feel a sense of civic duty or want people to think that they do, they virtue signal and try to fundraise with enamel pins and tote bags. Civic engagement in a local community could go miles farther without perpetuating consumerism and contributing to designer as celebrity. So he's pretty critical, and he touches on the rise of the celebrity designer. So personalities like Stefan Sagmeister or Paula Scher, who champion what he says is expression over modernism, where the personality comes first and the work comes second. He also touches a little bit on the design bubble and references communities like People of Craft and Women Who Draw and Women of Graphic Design that are actually a step in the right direction in attempting to address perhaps a lack of diversity in the design industry. But before I perhaps get into Eric's suggestions of what, you know, can be done to help fix some of the issues in the design industry as it is today, and this is probably a very like American US focused op-ed, I'm curious to hear from you three. And do you actually agree with this assessment of the state of the design industry today?
Look, I'm going to handball this. I want Frank to answer as the only bona fide graphic designer here. I'm especially interested hearing, you know, how you know your work intersects with journalism, as you kind of mentioned that before. Yeah, how did you react to this, Frank?
I know Eric Carter personally, and then we also have worked together many times at the New York Times Magazine and at Wired a little bit. And to me, it's funny because I was just reading a Tibor Kalman book, Perverse Optimist, which like has a lot of the same ideas baked into it. I mean, Tibor Kalman was like exactly this kind of figure, like challenging what we think about graphic design and what we're doing with ourselves when we design a logo for a corporation and what that means. So it was just funny to me, is very good timing. And it's sort of touching on what I was getting at before about working for tech and working for corporations. And I suppose it's also in my mind, living in San Francisco, I think there's a glorification of things that are highly consumable. And I think technology, especially right now in the United States and maybe the world generally, is viewed as a worthwhile pursuit, as if tech will better our lives or improve our day-to-day. And, you know, some companies do that. But I think there's now a company like Facebook, which a couple of years ago, people would feel very, very excited about working for, and not so much anymore, especially in the past 6 months. And companies like Apple, I mean, I think it's strange to me that a lot of these very talented designers are going to work there. And what does this mean for what their efforts are doing, and what are they selling by working there? And what is the message we're trying to convey by making a better marketing pitch or better advertisements or graphics for Apple?
I'm selling more apps.
I mean, exactly. You're selling more apps, and not to be trite, but it's selling computers.
But do you think this is a question that, I mean, that designers have a responsibility or even the capabilities to answer? And I think that's kind of one of my, not beefs, but like I kind of feel that I've heard this kind of call to action in a lot of different kind of guises before. And it kind of feels like it's a question that graphic designers kind of can solve. It really reminds me of Adbuster's kind of First Things First manifesto. Like that's when I first kind of heard it when I was kind of in school, like, I don't know, 100 years ago. And it's like, you know, and you talk about kind of these kind of cycles, and I feel like, yeah, you have these kind of, you know, outrage / activism kind of cycles, and like, you know, nothing feels kind of that different here. I think the one thing that is kind of interesting is the fact that I do think there is a need to champion more diverse kind of talent and diverse designers in this way. Like, I think, yeah, a lot of the people who've been running on the lecture circuit, like as kind of design lecturers, have been doing this for kind of so long. There's not a lot of diversity of voices there. And this whole idea about that these are kind of motivational speakers now, you know, and that's kind of what their job is. But yeah, that's why I was kind of interested in AR and tech in that way. It's like, you know, are technologists the ones who are going to be best suited to design these problems? And does that mean that technologists and coders need to have kind of design thinking, or that designers need to have kind of more skills of engineers and technologists? Does that mean their kind of role needs to change, or does the actual kind of profession need to change? I don't know. It's a real kind of sticky question. And I think it just needs to be addressed from a different place in some ways.
I think it's funny because, like, I mean, clearly Eric has an axe to grind, you know, he's not shy about this. And it's funny because, like, before I'd even had a chance to absorb what he was saying and sort of form any of my own thoughts on it, I was like ready to like strap on my boots and helmet and like join his army, because he's kind of this like charismatic graphic design version of like a socialist revolutionary leader. Like, he was like my graphic design Che Guevara or something when I was reading it. I was like, yeah, Eric, I'm in. And then like the more I thought about it, the more I sort of came to sort of slightly different conclusions myself, or that I think he's making something quite black and white that isn't necessarily. But I think anyway, you know, a lot of what he's saying is definitely drawn from perhaps like a sort of maturity or reflection on the industry that comes with experience. And I think perhaps the ideals he's spouting are, you know, without doubt things that could be positive for society as a whole. But I think a lot of who he's taking issue with or aim at are sort of like young, experienced designers of the sort of modern age. And I don't know that they yet have the capability of grasping exactly what he's saying before they've like matured to these realizations on their own. Anyway,
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Yeah,
so he's kind of shouting in aggressively into the ether until, you know, everyone else gets sort of like old and bitter about it as well.
I kind of feel like Eric is sort of hitting a point right now. I mean, right, the essay hits at a good time generally with everything that's going on in the United States at this moment, and like everyone's effort to try to be more aware and more conscious of our actions and our language and, you know, our place in the world. And I think what he's getting at is, how do you operate as a citizen? And as citizens, your tool is graphic design. And how do you choose to use that tool as a citizen? And I agree, like, I've never been one to say graphic design is going to change the world, and like, we should make a poster to create activism. Like, I strongly balk at those ideas or those efforts. But I think there's something more to the idea of who are you working for? And what does it mean to work there? And who are you hiring? And what kind of staff do you work for? And like, what general bigger presence are you contributing to in the design world and the world in general? I think it's trying to, I guess, put a magnifying glass on that occupation.
I completely, completely agree. I think everything that you're saying, that he's saying, is like, is more than valid. I just think as well, it definitely reeks of that same, like, I think about, you know, we work in advertising, and it's often that same realization that people come to after 20 years of working in the ad industry. They're like, why have I devoted my life to ads? You know, and you sort of like, yeah, and you have that midlife crisis of like, oh my God, I need to do something with purpose, and I need to, you know, and it's like, it's totally valid, but I also just think it's something that comes maybe like a little bit later, and you start to care about different things as you.
I think graphic design as a discipline and as it's kind of sold, though, it's like it always is this commercial art, and that's kind of something that I'm very passionate about, this whole blending of kind of art and commerce kind of in that way. And
I guess that's the difference. That's the distinction. Otherwise, you're an artist, not a graphic designer.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that's kind of, I oh man, it's so thorny. The more you kind of think about it, the more it kind of goes,
the labels make it tricky.
Look, I think the bottom line is that it's great for these pieces to get out there and to get published and for voices like this to be heard. And I think it's also interesting that the Walker Art Center was publishing it as well. I'm familiar with the Walker, Gallery Museum B, I think, I'm not even sure what or foundation. I've always kind of associated with them being a bit more of a kind of a stuffy, old school kind of practice. But it's interesting to use their kind of position as a platform for some of these ideas. There's some links to some other kind of smaller kind of niche, more kind of politically active design groups that Eric links to, that we will put in our show notes as well. Laura, tell us about your link for this week from Man Repeller.
Yeah. So, I'm here to dumb things down. this is a piece on Man Repeller titled Millennial Pink, Gen Z Yellow, and the Truth About Color Clickbait. And basically, it's looking at the sort of bizarre phenomenon that was millennial pink and what might be looking to overthrow it now. So, just for anyone who's been living under a rock for the last 5 years, millennial pink or Tumblr pink is that sort of blush, salmon, bubblegum, peachy, pinky hybrid that swallowed up every single corner of fashion, interior design, graphic design for a hot minute. And I think, you know, whenever it seemed to reach its peak and look sort of close to turning that sort of sad corner that all trends eventually turn, it just sort of fucking stayed put. And something this article highlights, as do many others about millennial pink, is that one of the reasons for its staying power was that it sold, plain and simple. Fashion labels sort of did try to put out new season items that heroed different colors, but that stock would just sit there for months and months while the pink stuff sort of flew out the door. And so it was this sort of self-perpetuating thing. And anyway, it seems to finally be kind of dying down, I guess, thanks to oversaturation, I guess. And you know, the funny thing is that something else will probably just take its place and, you know, serve exactly the same purpose or lack of purpose. But yeah, supposedly this article says there's an argument for Gen Z yellow, which in this piece they quote Katie Smith, who's a retail analyst and insights director. And she says, you know, even though retailers only lifted their new yellow arrivals by 0.2% in the last 3 months compared to the same period in 2017, sellouts of yellow grew 106%. And then they also make this case for lavender and lime green, you know, all the
like melodramatic lavender,
melodramatic purple and Miranda Hobbs. I don't know. But anyway, look, it is a bit silly on the surface. And I suppose that it is easy to write this sort of thing off as trivial. But when you sort of really think about the way that the extreme popularity of something as basic as a color can have such mammoth impacts on the way that so many aspects of our sort of world look and how we experience it. I mean, think about like every pink crushed velvet sofa you saw, every book cover, every restaurant wall, every logo, every flat lay background, every bomber jacket, like everything was designed with this sort of obsession with this color in mind. And it's hard to ignore the fact that trends like these do actually have a very real effect on how we experience and interact with our world. And there are just like thousands of think pieces on this as well, which just sort of goes to show even further just how much of a thing this was. So Frank, I want to know, like, how do things like millennial pink affect your work as a designer?
It doesn't really come into places like Wired.
Good to know. I am glad to hear it. But there's still color palette trends that I think must seep in somehow.
Sure, sure. I mean, Wired had a definite color palette for a few years. This neon green yellow was a real part of the Wired DNA for a while. But I would say as far as like millennial pink, it's something that seeps into my freelance work quite a bit. So I have a client that I work with and she asked for all of these blush tones for a project. Just because she likes them. And she likes them, why? Because she sees them everywhere and they look good on so-and-so and whatever. And it feels like she's on trend or on brand. I'm curious from the Jackie Winter point of view, like, is it something that comes into the illustrator's work and people, clients ask for? And that's something that you try to like mitigate and try to like dissuade clients from doing because it seems like a trend that it'll seem like it'll be hot for a minute or do you try to like, hey, that's what you want, we're doing it? Or
it's really tricky because in the one hand, I mean, this is, I'm just talking, you know, my own behalf here, but like, I think like there's, we are sort of in a bit of a service role where we are fulfilling what the client wants. And at the same time, like, often the reason the client wants it is because it does sell. Like it's like that statistically it sells and they're in the business of selling shit, you know? So by the time it gets to us, often the palette has been, you know, decided. And I do think that there are artists that like their work has gotten more popular in the last, you know, 5 years or so because it was like relevant to those sorts of palettes, those like pastel-y tones. Jeremy, do these things ever cross your like?
Yeah, color is such a tricky one. And like, I hate color, dealing with it so much. It's really hard because the trend aspect of it, because color is such a signifier in kind of so many ways. And I think to paint something like even like whether it's kind of a house or an office, like a physical thing, like having to paint a color, like you're only going to paint the kind of once. And then like in kind of, I don't know, like 10 years or something, like that color could signify something like a totally different time and how colors are kind of put together, you know, have a huge space on the overall kind of, you know, feeling of something. I think with illustrators and designers, it's so easy because your folio can always kind of adapt with those kind of changes and can kind of place you in kind of a certain time period. But I think not so much individual colors, but yeah, color schemes, how they kind of bring about certain kind of time periods because of this kind of mass psychosis where everybody kind of agrees this is the color of the moment. And I think, yeah, Pantone.
Like avocado green.
Well, Pantone has a huge role to play in this in terms of, you know, they come out like Groundhog Day every year and trot out there. This is the color of 2019. And often it's very arbitrary. I mean, I don't know who picks these things or whatever, but yeah, look, I found it a real kind of insightful article, like in terms of just kind of saying like, that, hey, this is a thing.
Yeah. I think like the thing that kind of annoys me about it is there's this like build up where like all the cool people sort of have this color and like to be cool, you have to wear this color. And then as it starts to go out of style, it then becomes cool to be like millennial pink, like all these, like all the masses that love this color. And like, that's insane. You should be able to just like a color because you like a color. It's, you know, I hate
it's just
the
easy to wear black.
Yes.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, you can take the girl away from Melbourne, but you can't take the Melbourne away.
I have to say, like, I showed up to San Francisco with like an 80% black wardrobe. And I felt kind of nuts after a while because it's like sun's shining and everyone's like, you know, tanned and I'm dressed in all black and all pale.
It's because people are actually happy in San Francisco. They're comfortable with wearing color.
Frank, you are the last cab off the rank here with your link. And I'm curious as well, like, you know, for someone like yourself, where do you find your links? And why is this something that you picked? And tell us a bit more about it.
Where do I find my links? I had a hard time coming up with a link for this podcast, I will admit. I say most of my links are from the New York Times or from, I guess, Wired now. I don't know. But this I found because a former coworker and friend of mine, still a friend, former coworker, Chloe Sheffy wrote it. And so I saw it via her Twitter. And she's a super talented person and someone I really admire. She's a designer. She also writes. She also illustrates. Anyway, it's about being a generalist versus being a specialist and how specialists used to be what one would admire and what one strives to. Like, I'm excellent at this one thing. And I think, you know, she's defending the idea of generalism where you can dabble into many different things and be good at those different things, or just, you know, be good at nothing, but are willing to explore it and try it and challenge yourself in that way, which I think is the best way to learn something, taking on something new, you have no idea what you're doing, and fiddling around with it, whatever it may be, like design or music or what have you. Yeah, I just loved the essay and her voice and just like some of the struggle she was going through with like wanting to be a specialist, but succumbing to the generalist idea.
Do you think, I mean, does this have any kind of crossover with, I guess, the concept of dilettantism or dilettantism, you know, being a dilettante, which is kind of somewhat can be a pejorative term?
I guess so. I was more focused on like what she was trying, what her personal struggle was. I'm pulling up the article right now. What is the thing I love to do most? What am I best at? And what am I? As if, you know, your design craft defines who you are and like your style defines who you are. And that's something I really respond to. And because I think, especially with editorial design, it's harder to have a real point of view because you're supposed to be designing for the magazine and for the story and for the concept. And so it becomes like a more of a looser, harder to sign your name on the bottom kind of design, you know?
That was
but you're still like an author though in some ways. Sorry, Laura. I'm just kind of curious how you feel that resonates with you personally, because like that's something as an editorial designer I kind of felt, even though my name wasn't kind of on the piece, that like I still would read the piece and kind of run it through my own filter and use photographers and illustrators and designers to kind of give that a whole different, you know, you're editorializing in some ways.
Sure. I agree with that to some extent, because it's of course your point of view, but I think the best editorial design, the design that gets me most excited, is the design that's like conceptually strong to the point where it conveys the idea in the most succinct way and sort of eliminates voice in a sense. Like, because of course the idea is from your voice, but I think if it's smart enough and clever enough and like thorough enough, the voice sort of disappears a little bit and it's just the idea in its like purest form. And that's always what I'm after.
Ooh, controversial. Laura, I'm sorry to cut you off before, but what were you going to say?
Oh, no. All I was going to say was that I was resonating with what Frank was saying, because the first thing that I thought about when reading this piece was that the difference in how he might answer it and how we might answer it, because I think it is different for designers and for illustrators, where it because of exactly what you're saying, Frank, like there's a much clearer, well, there's much more of an ability to have a voice in, you know, commercial illustration than there is in commercial design, where you are sort of having to react quite differently to whatever it is you're designing around, you know? And so I think, you know, we get artists, I mean, illustrators ask all the time, whenever I do a lecture, I do a talk or whatever, the number one question I always get is like, you know, should I have lots of different things in my folio, or should I just have like one kind of style? And it's like, it's a really tough question, because I think some people are good at being generalists, but more often than not, people are going to be better if they specialize.
I think the answer is relative. I mean, I get that question a lot too. And it's like, well, if you're going to be a freelance illustrator, you're going to probably be better to be a generalist, because that kind of expands the number of clients that you could potentially service. However, if you're looking for representation, you need to be a specialist, because the relationship that we have with our kind of clients is they're looking at folios and they kind of want to know, put you in a box kind of really quick and kind of know who you are. Would you agree with that, Frank, as someone who does commission artwork, that you need to kind of, that there's not that much space there for that kind of subtlety?
Yeah, unfortunately I do, because I want to know what I'm going to get when I hire someone. And so I need to see the thing on their site or something close to it, so I can understand what they're going to do and what their point of view is. But do you ever feel, not guilt, but like apprehension in trying to get an illustrator or artist to like go in one direction as opposed to trying different things?
I always tell our artists kind of two things. Like, one, that their portfolio is like a snakeskin, and that like it can, like, you know, you can always put new things and shed kind of old things. You can continually evolve your work that way. But I also think that working,
such a gross analogy, but yeah, right.
Well, but I mean, I think this is one thing that I'm very interested in terms of how work is actually kind of presented. And I also kind of think that the commissioning process especially for editorial work, is a chance that artists can kind of experiment kind of with new things and say like, hey, well, this is kind of the thing that, you know, you might have found me for, but, you know, this is kind of a new direction that I'm kind of thinking of. And like, you know, what would you think about kind of experimenting with this? So I think it really depends on, you know, how willing the art director is to kind of, you know, engage in that process. And obviously it depends where you're at, like, you know, in your schedule, or what kind of, how you kind of get along with the artist in that way. I feel being a specialist is kind of something that I kind of admire, because I think it rewards a certain type of kind of focus and attention that's harder to kind of come by these days, like to really dedicate yourself kind of to one thing. And I kind of always, I feel that this, the whole idea of kind of choice and how you can kind of dabble in a million different things and how much information is out there, like I find that to be kind of really, really paralyzing. So when I see someone who does have a singular aesthetic, or if I see a cafe that kind of focuses kind of in one specific thing, or a craftsperson who's kind of honed a specific skill, I don't know, like I do kind of value that more. So I'm not like, I think the idea of generalism as a professional kind of definition, I kind of doesn't really resonate with me. But the idea of curiosity, I think, yeah, it definitely is something that does.
That was something that like that I really took from this article. There was something that Chloe wrote, which I really liked. And she said, generalism, I now realize, is in my nature. I'm a generalist not because I think I'm good at everything, but because I think I'm very good at nothing. And I'm actually rereading The Tao of Poo by Benjamin Hoff at the moment. And like, funnily enough, like someone, I realized, I picked it up. I was back in Melbourne recently and picked it up from my parents' house. And there's like a note inscribed there. Someone gave it to me when I was 21 years old, but I cannot for the life of me like understand like who, like I can't read the handwriting to say like who actually gave me this book. So this like beautiful note, like, here's The Tao of Poo, like you should read this, it's really great, I've loved talking to you about like spirituality or whatever it is. I'm like, I have no clue who gave this to me at 21 years old. But anyway, there's some things in that that I think like on the same path as this, like in The Tao of Poo, he kind of says the wise are not learned, the learned are not wise, and the wise know their limitations, the foolish do not. And we've spoken a lot on this podcast about specifically what makes a good producer. And I think that curiosity and an openness and willingness to learn is absolutely up there. And to quote Chloe again, to be a persistent generalist is actually to be deeply, relentlessly ambitious. It is the natural byproduct of curiosity, of engagement, of unwavering standards, of the insatiable desire for excellence. So I think that, yeah, like this kind of willingness to be open to learning and to like learn new things and to follow a new path and something that's maybe a little bit scary is not a bad thing.
I totally agree with you in that. And then at the same time, I'm sort of torn because I think the problem is that like the idea of generalism as a whole, I understand it and I get it and I appreciate it. But also in order to be good, you know, in terms of design, illustration, art as a whole, in order to sort of be good at anything, it generally takes doing that kind of thing over and over and over again. And if you are constantly flitting between different styles, you're never allowing yourself to be sort of good, which is where that whole, you know, jack of all trades, master of none thing kind of comes in. And it's like, let's say I could take, you know, my five favorite artists that have very singular sort of strong voices and mush them in together to one person who could do all of those things equally well. Hell yeah, that would be incredible. Like, what a generalist. That would be amazing. But I just don't know that very, very few people are able to be good at lots of things.
Yeah. It's funny, but I think that because of the size of the population of Australia compared to America and the lack of kind of resources, I think that like living in America as an Australian, I think that you start to realize very quickly that Australians are inherently generalist because of the fact that we have to wear a lot of hats. Like I've seen firsthand from like a lot of like Australian friends that move over here to the States to try and like find a job, and they have difficulty landing a job because American hiring managers have difficulty kind of putting them in a box. But then that on the flip side, once they actually get into the workforce and especially in corporate like America, they become invaluable because of their ability to be agile and to wear many hats.
Oh, look, a lot of food for thought here. As always, every week, a different assortment of amazing thought-provoking links. So, Frank, thank you so much for coming and sharing that with us. Really interesting. Where can people find you if they want to know more all about you?
you can just find me on my website. It's myfirstandlastname.com or Instagram or what have you. My last name is pretty easy to find.
Fantastic. Well, closing out as we like to every week, we're changing it up. Laura, we changed this up a little bit in your absence last week. And
yeah, you said something in the intro that shocked me.
Well, we ran out of things to complain about. It turns out
Well, no, I think it was more that we didn't run out of things to complain about. I think, Jeremy, you just wanted to be a little bit more positive.
I did want to be a bit more positive, but also I find that like anytime you turn something into a job, it gets incredibly harder. So I think like as soon as I had to task myself with finding something to actually find to complain about every week, it was harder.
This segment's going to become like just say anything.
Whatever you want to air, just talk about. Yeah, just an open platform.
Yes. Laura, you're in a safe space. What would you like to talk about this week?
Anything? Well, I thought I was meant to bring a complaint, so I'm ready to complain, and yes, then you guys can lift the tone. I mean, look, it's not a long one. I want to complain about Instagram TV.
Oh my God.
Because thank you. Like, I was like, am I an old person or is this just completely unnecessary? Like, and I know they're trying to do battle with like YouTube and whatever, but like, I already like Instagram. Instagram people already use you enough. Like, you don't need to add more. It's just adding a completely unnecessary level. And I don't have the capacity to learn another facet of the social media.
Don't want another vertical to integrate with our already emerging social media platform?
No, I do not. And it's also like, there's so many fucking stupid, sorry to swear all the time about this in this segment, but things make me annoyed. But like, there's so many annoying influencers already on Instagram that like, I can sort of stomach if they're like 10-second videos. But now that they have room to be making these like huge long pieces that are just like automatically coming up on my screen. 10 minutes is a long time to listen to someone talk about like skinny me tea or whatever. And like, it's just too much. Anyway, I'm over it already. Goodbye.
Frank, anything that you would like to voice your strong opinions about either for or against?
I didn't come prepared, but you know, when pressed, I would say Kanye.
That's just your fallback over there.
Yeah, I right now it is. Yeah, I mean, he's the fucking worst. I mean, honestly, like I am not a fan of his music, but besides that, his whole like aligning with Trump and his recent politics and his wife going to the White House. Just come on, fuck off. But yeah.
That's
see,
accurate.
Didn't that feel good? There you go.
Yeah. It felt pretty good.
We all feel better.
B?
I have a whinge today as well. Every Monday, as you know, before we record the podcast, I go to my favorite spin class with my favorite spin instructor. But tonight she was away and we had a sub. What is up with spin instructors who can't actually instruct to the beat of the music? Like, the point of a spin class is that you ride the bicycle to the beat of the music. Like, how are you supposed to get into the groove of a class when for some reason, like, yeah, there was, okay, I should have known because, like, he started the spin class. I'm pretty sure he was playing Jack Johnson, which is not really an appropriate spin song. He was counting to 9. Last I heard, Untouched by the Veronicas was in 4/4 time, not something crazy like 5/9. Like, I don't, like, how can you count to 9 and then expect you to, like, change from, like, sitting to standing? I just don't get it.
You were in some kind of crazy experimental time signature class.
I
love it.
Jeremy.
I just watched this weekend The Fourth Estate, the New York Times doco. Frank, have you seen this? I would assume
I haven't. I've been meaning to, but I have not.
It's so good, but this is kind of something that I cannot deal with messy desks. And
can you stop looking at me while you're talking about this?
That wasn't intentional. Everyone that works in the New York Times, I'm kind of concerned, like, for their health. They look deeply unhealthy. I don't know. They seem not to see their families or eat anywhere like else. And but, like, the desk situation is crazy. Like, what are all these books and papers doing there? Like, they just kind of seem to land there and just, like, never leave. And I know people that have worked at the Times. I've been in the offices, and I really just wish they would clean up a bit. I find it existentially
actually
difficult.
So the cleaner here at the office comes in every weekend and, like, sort of organizes my mess into sort of, like, neat piles. And I was looking for a document the other day, and I was, like, searching through the pile because I always, like, compile everything. And it's like, because it's organized chaos. Like, I know what's in each pile of mess, and then they mix all up the piles into one pile, and it's very annoying. Anyway, and I found that they had stacked in amongst sort of documents and brochures, or whatever, some, like, an old tea bag. Like, they'd included it in the pile.
Oh, my God.
Just get rid of it.
We're going to talk about this. Okay. Excellent. Thank you, everyone, so much. Thank you, B.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Instagram and not Instagram TV yet at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We're also on Stitcher as well as Spotify if that is your thing. To receive all the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little email, you can sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter, and archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye. Bye.